We are at Daniel chapter 5 and 6, kind of two chapters a week here. As Ray Steadman points out in the notes I gave you on week one, the book of Daniel has a series of very strong moral lessons on godly conduct in times of trouble, of the testing of one's faith, of the importance of being faithful to God, and those are juxtaposed with the prophetic messages. And in order to understand the prophetic messages, as Ray points out, it's important that we understand that a close walk with God, a thorough knowledge of the Bible, is necessary if we're to understand the last part of the book. In the way it's starting next week, we're going to see glimpses into the future. Last week, we had... what happened last week? We had Daniel out of town, and Nebuchadnezzar making a great image of gold and commanding that everybody worship him, thinking that he was God, and he was the greatest monarch in the ancient world, the greatest, most powerful tyrant the world's ever known. And he commands the worship of all men, and Daniel's friends, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, now about 30 years old or so, refuse the king and are thrown into a very hot furnace and emerging alive, accompanied by a fourth person, the son of the gods. Nebuchadnezzar is amazed at this, and the strong, brave soldiers who threw these three men into the furnace are consumed by the flames in the midst of that. And these three brave men have told Nebuchadnezzar ahead of time that God was able to save them out of the furnace, but if it was their time to be burned up, they'd be happy to be burned up. So they're certainly men of courage and integrity. In chapter 4, the time scale is jumping all over the place. Chapter 4 is quite a bit later, more later in the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, who reigned 43 years. He has a great vision about a great tree sheltering beasts and birds and providing food, and the tree gets chopped down in his dream, and the stump is tied off with bands of iron and brass for 7 years. And Daniel reluctantly interprets the dream. Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar are good friends by this point, and the dream is not good news for Nebuchadnezzar at all. The dream is a prediction that because of Nebuchadnezzar's pride and his arrogance, God's going to cut him down to size, and he's going to have 7 years of insanity. Nebuchadnezzar ignores the interpretation by Daniel, and 1 year later, the judgment of God falls on him, and he goes out of his mind for 7 years and wanders around hopelessly insane, acting like an animal. But at the end of the time, he comes back to his senses and writes the account of this humbling experience, which gives every reason to suspect that he came to know the Lord during that time period. And I think most Bible commentaries think that he came to the Lord. And Calvin is an exception. Calvin thought that he might not be converted, but let's assume that he was, and we can talk to him when we see him. Saddam Hussein has rebuilt the palace of Nebuchadnezzar and the throne room and the banquet hall we're going to go visit today here. Now, chapter 5 jumps way ahead. Daniel is now an old man. We're going to jump ahead almost to the end of the whole Babylonian Empire. The whole Babylonian Empire is the total time period is only 100 years. That's not very long for a kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar died and was replaced on the throne by his son, Evil-Merodach, who ruled how many years? Let's see. My notes are so small I can't read them here today. 2 years, and he was 1 or 2 years and killed by his son, his brother-in-law, who took the throne, and that man was succeeded by an outsider, Nabonidus. And Nabonidus is a co-ruler with a man named Belshazzar. These last kings are kind of weak, and the great power of Babylon is waning, and there's a lot of feuding and corruption going on in the palace. And we the story of chapter 5 is about a great party that Belshazzar throws in the royal throne room built by his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar. It is likely that Belshazzar was the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. It's possible he was. Now, he was co-regent with Nabonidus, and we kind of know this from more recent archaeology and more recent history. Nabonidus was out of town a great deal. He was out renewing the religious sites, and he was out engaged in military battles, and we now know that Belshazzar was left in charge pretty much of the internal affairs of the city of Babylon during this time period, which is this was disputed until fairly recently. Now we know that Nabonidus and Belshazzar were co-regents together. And we're right now to the time when the Babylonian Empire is going to disappear in one night. Chapter 5. So we're way ahead now to 539 B.C. Belshazzar, the king, the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, he might have even been the blood grandson of Nebuchadnezzar, it's possible, adopted by Nabonidus just to make things look right. Nabonidus was not of the family of Nebuchadnezzar. Belshazzar the king made a great feast for 1,000 of his lords, and he drank wine in the presence of the 1,000 through a great big bash. And the very room, if you go to Babylon, I'm told, where the U.S. Marine Corps has a little office right now, this big throne room is there, this big banquet room, and it's 80-some feet by 150 feet, and you can put 1,000 guests in there without any problem. While he tasted his wine, Belshazzar gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his father, there's no word in Aramaic for grandfather, his father's father, Nebuchadnezzar, gave the command to bring the gold and silver vessels which his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple which had been in Jerusalem, in order that the king and his lords and his wives and his girlfriends, concubines, might drink from them. Then they brought the gold vessels that had been taken from the temple of the house of God, which had been in Jerusalem, and the king and his lords and his wives and his concubines drank from them. They drank wine and praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze, iron, wood, and stone. Anything wrong there? pretty badly wrong. Nebuchadnezzar's attitude? When his grandfather reached the end of his life? Nebuchadnezzar, by the way, had about another year of reign after he came back from his insanity, and he certainly showed reverence towards the God of Israel, or even belief in the God of Israel, and would have treated the things of God much differently than his grandson Belshazzar. And now the temple treasures from the temple, what are those? Gold and silver vessels from the temple. What are they used for? For the temple worship, to be used by the priests in the temple in Jerusalem. So these are God's sacred vessels. It's kind of open flaunting and desecration of all that's holy and sacred to the Jews and sacred in the temple in Jerusalem. You don't do that with God's sacred vessels and from the temple. And they praised the gods of gold and silver, bronze and iron, wood and stone. So Belshazzar's forgotten anything that he learned from his grandfather, or anything that he might have learned from anybody, any other godly influence, and he's deliberately embracing the pagan gods of Babylon. In the same hour, the fingers of a man's hand appeared and wrote opposite the lampstand on the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. This is the handwriting on the wall episode that we speak of today. When you see the handwriting on the wall, you know that's an omen of impending disaster. We still use that expression. The king's countenance changed, his thoughts troubled him, so that the joints of his hips were loosened and his knees knocked together against each other. Now, I'll give you a little clue here. That term, joints of his hips were loosened, is a reference to his bowels. So I leave that to you to put that in a common vernacular. He was pretty shook up here at this point. Hebrew has these discreet ways of saying things. So he's really shaken by this whole event. And it's embarrassing, of course. the king cried aloud to bring in the astrologers, the Chaldeans, the soothsayers. The king spoke, saying to the wise men of Babylon, "Whoever reads this writing and tells me its interpretation shall be clothed with purple, have a chain of gold around his neck, and be the third ruler in the kingdom." For a long time, people wondered why this was the mention of a third ruler. Well, now we know that Nabonidus would have been number one and Belshazzar number two, so obviously the next lower official would have been number three, and whoever can interpret this handwriting on the wall gets this immediate reward of being prime minister. All the king's wise men came, but they could not read the writing or make known to the king its interpretation. The writing's probably in Aramaic. It's probably not in some foreign language. It might have been written vertically, or maybe it's written in an unusual script. The meaning, the words are pretty clear, as we'll see in a minute. King Belshazzar was greatly troubled. His countenance was changed, and his lords were astonished. Really ruined the dinner party. The queen, because of the words of the king and his lords, came to the banquet hall. Now, this is likely to be the queen mother, not the wife of Belshazzar. Belshazzar's got a bunch of wives and girlfriends, and they're all there having this big party. The queen mother, if that's Belshazzar's mother or grandmother, she was not present at this big wild party. Maybe she wasn't invited, or maybe just out of her own godly thinking, she stayed away from it. But she hears this commotion in the banqueting hall and comes in to the banquet hall. And the queen spoke, saying, "O king, live forever. Do not let your hearts trouble you, nor let your countenance change. There is a man in your kingdom in whom is the spirit of the holy God. In the days of your father, in the days of your grandfather Nebuchadnezzar, light and understanding and wisdom, like the wisdom of the gods, was found in him. And King Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather the king, made him, Daniel, chief of the magicians, astrologers, Chaldeans, and soothsayers, inasmuch as an excellent spirit, knowledge, understanding, interpreting dreams, solving riddles, and explaining enigmas was found in this Daniel, whom the king named Belteshazzar. Now, let Daniel be called, and he will give the interpretation." Daniel's also not at this dinner party. How old is Daniel by this time? About 81, yeah. Remember, we first met him, he was 15, 16 years old, so we've got a big lapse of time here. He's up to 80 in his 80s now. Daniel was brought in before the king, and the king spoke and said to Daniel, "Are you that Daniel who is one of the captives from Judah, whom my grandfather the king brought from Judah?" Kind of a little bit of a low blow here to Daniel being called one of the captives when he'd been in Babylon all those long years and served in the government so faithfully. "I have heard of you that the Spirit of God is in you, and that light and understanding and excellent wisdom are found in you. The wise men, the astrologers, have been brought in before me, that they should read this writing and make known to me its interpretation, but they could not give the interpretation of this thing. I have heard of you, that you can give interpretations and explain enigmas. Now, if you can read the writing and make known to me its interpretation, you shall be clothed with purple and have a chain of gold around your neck, and you shall be the third ruler of the kingdom." That's public announcement. You notice that Daniel doesn't have a place in the government of Belshazzar. Belshazzar has ignored him, which Nebuchadnezzar certainly didn't do. Because Daniel and his friends served faithfully in the government of Nebuchadnezzar through Nebuchadnezzar's whole lifetime. So he makes the same promise. "If you can understand it, I'll make you number three in my government," which won't last very long. Daniel, now look how what Daniel does. He does not come in with the usual polite greeting to the king. No greeting, which would be kind of not the right protocol in a way. He comes right up and looks the king in the eye and he says, "Keep your gifts. Let your gifts be for yourself. And give your rewards to another." That's kind of an insult. When the king offers you this high honor and wants to give you these great gifts and you say, "I'm not here because of that at all. I will read the reading to the king and make known its interpretation. And now, right in front of the whole audience, Daniel preaches a little sermon here, just to remind everybody what they already knew, but to get the message out. O king, the Most High God gave Nebuchadnezzar, your grandfather, a kingdom and majesty and glory and honor. And because of the majesty that he gave him, all peoples, nations, and languages trembled and feared before him. Whomever he wished, he executed. Whomever he wished, he kept alive. Whomever he wished, he set up. And whomever he wished, he put down. But when his heart was lifted up and his spirit was hardened in pride, he was deposed from his kingly throne, and they took his glory from him. Then he was driven from the sons of men. His heart was made like the beasts. His dwelling was with the wild donkeys. They fed him with grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven until he knew that the Most High God rules in the kingdom of men and appoints over it whomever he chooses. A little review of history. But you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, although you knew all this. Whoops. You have lifted yourself up against the Lord of heaven. They have brought the vessels of his house, God's house, before you, and you and your lords and your wives and concubines have drunk wine from them, and you have praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, gods which do not see or hear or know, and the God who holds your very breath in his hand and owns all your ways, you have not glorified. Open. Pretty frank pronouncement right to the face of the king in the presence of his whole court and all the guests. The fingers of the hand were sent from him, and the writing was finished and clear. And this is the inscription which was written on the wall, Meni, Meni, Tekel, Upharsin. These are words about weighing and numbering, as we'll see here. This is the interpretation of each word, Daniel says. Meni, God has numbered your kingdom and finished it. Tekel, you have been weighed in the balances and found wanting. Perez, your kingdom has been divided and has been given to the Medes and the Persians. Belshazzar gave the command, and they clothed Daniel with purple and put a chain of gold around his neck and made a proclamation concerning him that he should be the third ruler in the kingdom. Sounds like Belshazzar doesn't humble himself, is ignoring the message, and he has to keep his promise by honoring Daniel and trying to get this party finished and back in order again. So that's not the end of the story. Now, we don't wait 1 year as we waited with Nebuchadnezzar for the judgment of God to fall. It's already fallen. There's this immediate verse 30. That very night, Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain. And Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. Suddenly, that night. Now, the details of how this happened are known from secular history, from Herodotus and from others. Herodotus says that the ancient city of Babylon was about 14 miles square, about 55 or 60 miles around in a circle, had about 1 million people, had two great big walls, an inner wall and an outer wall, 350 feet high. Herodotus exaggerated sometimes. We can't always trust Herodotus a little bit. The road on top of the walls was said to be 87 feet wide, so you could drive four chariots around these walls. In between the two walls was a space of a half a mile, which had 30 acres of good farmland on it, so that if there was a big siege, you could stay off, hold up inside the city, and grow crops and survive very nicely. And the Euphrates River ran in under the wall of the city and the north end and down the south end. So this is an impregnable city. There's just no way anybody's going to take this city. Nabonidus is out fighting. He's out fighting around elsewhere. But Belshazzar is certainly perfectly safe in having a big party in his throne room in this great city of Babylon. Place that probably, you remember the Hanging Gardens and the splendor and lavishness of the city. That we've all learned about from childhood. Now, what happened that caused him to lose his whole kingdom in one night and for him to be killed? And probably most of everybody in that banquet room was killed too. The clever Medes and the Persians have a little strategy. They simply dam up the Euphrates River and divert it, and it flows right under the city wall, so now they can put soldiers both in the north and in the south where the river has now dried up and send their armies right in under the wall. Nobody thought to put gratings or protection in the riverbed at all. So the army came in on dry land, took the city from the inside that very night while the party's going on, and Belshazzar comes to the end of his reign. And Daniel's position in office only lasts a few hours, as being number three in this kingdom. Sudden, abrupt judgment of God. The judgment of God, no way you can defend against it. No way you can stop God. You can't fortify yourself against this. Interesting. Yeah. 80-something. In his 80s. Yes. You know, it's in your notes there today. Upharsin, the UP on the Farsin is the and. I forgot to look that. I put it in the front of your notes, the derivation of the words, and in there. Okay. And also in your notes, I had a little bit on this family history of the troubled kingdom from Nebuchadnezzar to Belshazzar. So this is the end of the Babylonian Empire. The Babylonian Empire falls suddenly. Could we have had any basis of understanding that Babylon would fall one day, suddenly and abruptly? Would we have had any prior warning other than this banquet? Well, we could have read Isaiah, the prophet, who talked about this 150 years earlier, and he talked about the sudden destruction of Babylon the Great. Why is Babylon going to suddenly be destroyed? That's God's judgment on them for destroying Israel and for their arrogance and pride as a great nation. And it comes suddenly to a halt. Now, Daniel could easily, since he's number three, in comes the conquering army, they could easily have killed Daniel. They didn't. They spared his life. They probably, in addition to killing Belshazzar, they killed most, probably the nobles and most of the high government officials right then and there. Now, the king who comes in here is called Darius the Mede. Daniel said that Babylon would fall to a man named Cyrus, the Persian, and names him by name. Daniel named Cyrus by name 150 years earlier that would be the king. Anybody have any thoughts on that? It's a little controversial. Again, I clarified, looked in your notes. Some people think that Cyrus and Darius are one and the same. It's more likely that Cyrus has appointed Darius as his main general, and that Darius is the one that actually brings in the conquering army, and he's working for Cyrus. The Medes and the Persians have joined together in an alliance to destroy Babylon, and so it is the Medes and the Persians who come in, and it's very likely then that this Darius the Mede is the general that comes in and takes the city. Okay? There's a later Darius that we'll run onto later in Persian history, not the same guy. Okay. End of the Babylonian Empire. Whole new administration comes in. A whole new form of government. Probably not. I think his own vanity and his own false sense of security. And Nabonidus has got his main army out doing, fighting the Medes and Persians remotely. And I think he imagines himself safely holed up in his palace, this big city that couldn't be conquered by any known means. I imagine he doesn't have a lot of intelligence going on. No satellite pictures or no CNN to show that there's a diversion going on in the river. Yes. Yeah. Yeah, he would have known that there were armies outside the city. The besieging army was there, and I think he had this false sense of security that Babylon was was invulnerable to attack. Okay? Interesting. Kingdoms can fall very, very suddenly by the judgment of God and through unexpected ways and means. And we now move on to the new government. And is Daniel going to have a place in the new government? Yes, indeed he is. He's now a few years older, maybe 85, 86. It pleased Darius to set over his kingdom 120 satraps, vice presidents, or presidents, to be over his whole kingdom. And over these 120 vice presidents, three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them, so the king would suffer no loss. This Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. The king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. Now, we got a different kind of government. Under Nebuchadnezzar, we had an absolute monarch whose word was law, and there was nobody to challenge him. He did whatever he pleased. Now we have a different form of government. We've moved from the head of gold down on the great image of Nebuchadnezzar's dream. We've moved down to the chest of silver, and we've moved to a weaker form of government. This weaker form of government means the power of the king is moderated, because now there's this high council of 120 vice presidents, and there's also, in addition to that, the rule of law has been added in as a kind of a form of checks and balances in the government. So the power of the king has been reduced a notch. Right? Daniel's way up there. This is just amazing that God has moved him on up into the number three spot in the government, and maybe even to, will soon be prime minister. Because an excellent spirit was in him. Amazing. And this pagan king, Darius, recognizes that. Now I have the New King James. What does it through yours say? Quality, just his quality. Extra credit if somebody would like to go look up the Aramaic there for us and see. Thank you. All right. Now, what's happening now? We're going to have a little intrigue in the government. Verse 4. So the governors and the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom. But they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error found in him. Some of his fellow leaders in the government don't like him very much, and they want some reason to get him out of there. But they hunt around for some scandal or some reason, something they can dig up out of the past against him, and they can't find anything. Why do they want to get rid of Daniel when he's obviously such a good man and so good for the country and so good for the community? Why do they not like him? Jealousy and envy and, yeah. And Daniel's going to get in trouble because he's messed up really badly with God? No. His record with God is beyond reproach in any detail at all. Do people get in trouble just for being godly? Yes. Good example here. In fact, the more godly, the more likely you're to get in trouble for nothing that you've done. These men said to themselves, they get together, "We shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God." Boy, if he's messed up someplace, it'll probably be in some detail of the law of Moses that we don't know very much about, because we certainly can't find anything wrong with his bookkeeping and his accounting and his administration and his fair treatment of people and the whole time he's been in government all these long years since he was a boy. And we have his academic record from Nebuchadnezzar's university, and he's without reproach. These governors and satraps thronged before the king and said to him, "King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and the satraps, the counselors and advisors, have consulted together." That's not true. They haven't all consulted together because they have excluded Daniel from their committee meeting here. We have all decided to form a decree for your benefit, O King. And the decree should read as follows. Whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O King, shall be cast into a den of lions. After all, you are the greatest, O King, and we simply want to honor you and protect you because you're such a wonderful man. And they find this little weak spot in the king's vanity, and he says, oh yeah, that's a good idea. Now, O King, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Something once signed into law in the customs of the Medes and Persians can't be revoked, and the king can't go around the requirements of the law, even though he signed it. He doesn't have veto power over the law. King Darius signed the written decree, thinking it was in his own benefit and everybody else's benefit. When Daniel knew that the writing had been signed, obviously Daniel's high up in the government, should have been in this committee meeting. It's done behind his back. He's not in it anywhere. Doesn't even know it's been signed. He went home. In his upper room, with his windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees three times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. Didn't do anything differently than he had done. He didn't close the window. There's his porch, and you see, you can go across the street and see Daniel praying three times a day in the direction of Jerusalem. Why did he pray in the direction of Jerusalem? Couldn't you pray any other direction? Where does that come from, that custom or tradition of praying in the direction of Jerusalem? Solomon. Solomon put that in his prayer, that if the nation sins and if the people are away from the land, if they would pray in the direction of this temple and this house, Solomon asked that God would hear his people. And so Daniel is respecting that, and he's praying three times a day in the direction of Jerusalem, and anybody that wants to see him praying can. And these three men assembled, naturally, part of a conspiracy, and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God, which he had done for 50, 60 years now, faithfully every day, three times a day, so it's not anything different. They went before the king, and they spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or any man within 30 days, except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? King answered and said, this thing is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be altered. They answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who is one of the captives from Judah, once again, that's kind of dishonoring to Daniel, who's been so faithful in government, doesn't matter where he came from, does not show due regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but he makes his petitions three times a day. The king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself, and he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored until the going down of the sun to deliver him. Why is Darius upset with himself? I made a bad mistake. I'm going to put to death one of the best men in my government, the guy that I'd like to have for prime minister, who's got this unblemished public record, and I've just been tricked into getting rid of him, and spends the whole day trying to wiggle out of it somehow. Only when the king has a decree, ordinarily you'd execute somebody that very day, and so a little bit later on in the afternoon, these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes can be changed. We got you, O king. Yeah. Very much that same kind of... That the enemies of God and the enemies of Daniel have out of their jealousy, have conspired to influence the king to do something that's going to be in his own worst interest, and the king listens, and God's in charge. Well, we'll see what happens. The king gave the command reluctantly. He finally has to give this public command, this public matter, on the evening news, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you." Sounds like Darius kind of suspects that there may be a God big enough to help Daniel, and he's probably heard all the stories of Daniel's previous exploits and the three friends of Daniel saved from the burning fiery furnace, and he certainly hopes. He hopes that the lions won't devour Daniel. A stone was brought and laid on the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet ring of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. We've got three kings involved in here. We've got King of Babylon, and we've got the King of the Beasts involved, and we've got the King of Kings. So we've got three kings here, and all these three kings are working together to protect this one man, this one servant. It's very interesting. The king went to his palace and spent the whole night fasting. No musicians were brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. So he tossed and turned all night and worried and might have even prayed a little bit. And the first thing in the morning, the king gets up very early and he goes in haste to the den of lions. He came to the den and cried out with a lamenting voice. He's afraid that his friend Daniel has indeed been devoured by the lions. But he cries out anyway. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions?" Isn't that beautiful? Yeah. And Daniel said to the king, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouth, so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I've done no wrong before you." God sends an angel and shuts up the mouths of the... And Daniel turns over, sleeps, and has a very good night's sleep, and nobody else gets any sleep that night. The king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. Daniel was taken up out of the den. No injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. King gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel and cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. Josephus says that that the stories were circulating around at the time of this, that the lions had been well fed ahead of time, and so they weren't hungry. But the account here is that these were plenty hungry. That they were very happy to have a meal. So we've got, you can't say that the lions had been secretly well fed by somebody or other before Daniel was put into the lion's den. Now, was that a nice thing to do for Darius to put these men, the conspirators, and their wives and their children into the den and have them all eaten up? Well, probably wasn't very just for the kids. But the king can do whatever he wants, and he's very, very angry now. And he knows where the problem is, and he's been tricked and deceived. So he solves the problem really quickly and gets rid of these guys and their families and the hungry lions. Anybody ever been up to the San Francisco Zoo and seen real lions? They are huge, and they roar, and they shake the building, and they're something. Yeah. That's true. Suppose Daniel had been eaten up. Yeah, and the king, suppose Daniel had been eaten up by the lions and he was gone, and the next day the king is thinking over this conspiracy, and then the king might very well have said, "Well, these are bad guys, throw them in too." Yeah, one way or another they got in trouble. Yeah. Yes, read that for us. Good. The Lion of Judah. Well, these were hungry lions. I don't think anybody's going to complain if Daniel prays. Now look at what King Darius does. Nebuchadnezzar, remember, when Nebuchadnezzar went through this humbling experience, he wrote it up and had it published. The story of his insanity and the recovering of his insanity. When he came back to his senses, he wrote this beautiful, eloquent story of how he was humbled. Darius now is sufficiently moved that he does the following. King Darius wrote a proclamation. To all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. And Darius now has dominion over the known Gentile world. He's the absolute ruler over the nations in and around the Middle East. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel. That's kind of neat, isn't it? It seems to me that what characterizes the times in which we live right now, above all else, is the verse in Romans, there's no fear of God before their eyes. That characterizes our country, our nation, our general social life. No fear of God before their eyes. No reverence, respect, awe at all. Open blasphemy and insults towards God. And Darius is smart enough to realize that you better stand in awe of the real God. He is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his dominion shall endure to the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works signs and wonders in heaven and on earth, who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions. This Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Prospered in his mid and late 80s. Now, this may well mean that King Darius got converted. It seems like he might have. Certainly was humbled and showed respect towards God. How does this apply to our nation or to Christians living in any nation anywhere? We've had now all these great insights into Daniel and his friends and how they conducted themselves when they'd been taken captives and they were off in a foreign land and under foreign power. What does this mean for us? The judgment of the United States is absolutely certain. Yes, that's right. God's own timing and in his own way, yep. The most effective people of God in this whole story are sort of low profile there. The servants of the king, willing to serve the king faithfully and loyally and be honest. Yeah, there's a military base there at Babylon, partly to protect the antiquities. I found a Marine Corps website this week, and I think it's in your notes that they're taking pictures. Of course, you have some Christians in the military over there are all excited to be living in the city of Babylon. I hope they're praying. I hope so. Yeah. That's true. That's true. That's absolutely right. On what basis does God judge individuals and nations? By how much they know? Yeah. By our obedience to what we do know about God, yeah. We have lots of good Christians here, yeah. Say Saddam said that he was the new Nebuchadnezzar, and when he built the palace, he had all the bricks stamped over with his logo on them, so it was clear that he's the new Nebuchadnezzar. He forgot about Nebuchadnezzar's conversion, I think, here, apparently. Is it proper for Christians, then, to have an influence in government, to speak out against government, to obviously within in polite, respectful ways? Yes. What happens to people in political, in power and office? Pride is a great enemy of mankind, and vanity, and monarchs need to be humbled, and I like that. That's good. Why shouldn't we all get in trouble from time to time simply because we're servants of God and we live lifestyles that are different than the lifestyles of the pagan world around us? Shouldn't we expect to have conflict? God's utterly reliable and faithful, yeah. And here's this Daniel has been there. He's now up in his 80s. Never see his parents again. Never see Jerusalem again. He's going to live the rest of his life there, serving God and serving his people in Babylon. Very pagan city, yes. Sometimes it's hard to know what's going on in a situation that's in the news like that because we just usually get a few snapshots and don't understand all the dynamics of who's doing what to whom and for why, and it gets a little complicated. In a nation where there's so much general knowledge about God, yes, and it's not finished yet. The story's not ended yet. This is a great book. Now, next week, we're going to get, we move into the prophetic section. Daniel has a great dream. Daniel has a dream which parallels the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had had many, many years earlier, 50 years earlier or so. And the dream of great wild beasts and horns. And we've got a lot going. From now on through the book of Daniel, we get these great prophetic sections, which should be lots of fun reading. Should give us all individual boldness, yeah. I was just reading something. Ray Stedman, in his commentary on John, said that he was going through the Palo Alto phone book and found 36 churches in Palo Alto. Didn't think we needed 36 churches in Palo Alto. And if there were 36 in Palo Alto, then there's hundreds of thousands of churches in California and millions of churches in the U.S. Did we really need that many churches? The early Christians were just a handful, and look what they did. Just a small in number. I think that was humorous. Well, let's quit for the day. Our Father, thank you for these very marvelous stories from Daniel, and many of us have heard them since childhood, and they haven't lost their power at all. They're just wonderful illustrations of God's people being faithful in an evil, hostile world, and of the mighty God behind the scenes, directing the affairs of men. Thank you that you're just, that you know how to humble, and you know how to protect your people. And I pray that we could all be more willing to get in trouble for doing the right thing, not doing the wrong thing. And that these lessons could be a source of great encouragement for us. And we could discern the times in which we live and know when to speak and how to speak and how to be effective to make a difference, and not just be complacent and apathetic. So also we're going to need your help in the next few weeks to see clearly the prophetic sections that are difficult, and that depends on our walk with you. It depends on our being in a good strong daily relationship with you and walking with you and knowing you. So grant that, Father. Thanks that your grace is sufficient, that your mercy is renewed every morning, that your protection is something we can count on. Thanks for choosing us to be part of your glorious kingdom, which is soon coming down on the earth. In the name of Jesus. Amen. I think the cassette tapes are apparently available from Discovery Publishing if you want to order them.